A federal judge from Miami is in the eye of the Trump storm. Our education reporter has some parting thoughts, and Panama's president-elect wants to close the Darien gap. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at the controversy surrounding Aileen Cannon, the Miami-raised federal judge who's facing a lot of criticism over her handling of former President Donald Trump's classified documents trial. We'll also say farewell to WLRN education reporter Kate Payne, but not before she weighs in on some critical issues. And we'll discuss Panama's president-elect, Jose Raul Mulino, who wants to shut down a route so many migrants use to get here. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. Former President Donald Trump's federal criminal trial involving his handling of classified documents that was supposed to begin this month, on May 20th. But this week, the U.S. District Court judge, Aileen Cannon of Miami, indefinitely delayed the trial until at least well into the summer and perhaps until after the November presidential election. Trump, who appointed Cannon to the federal bench, is the presumptive Republican presidential candidate. And if he wins, he could very well make this trial disappear. And so Judge Cannon is facing a storm of criticism, not just from Trump opponents, but from legal experts who question her grasp of the issues involved in this case. In her delay ruling this week from the federal courthouse up in Fort Pierce, Florida, Cannon insisted she was just being prudent and respecting the court's duty. But this and other controversies in this trial have cast a spotlight on the Colombian-born judge who has otherwise built a stellar resume since her school days in Miami. What are your thoughts about Judge Aileen Cannon's conduct in the Trump classified documents trial? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, excuse me. And joining me now in the studio to look deeper into this is Jay Weaver, who's been following this story as the federal courts and crime reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald. Jay, always great to have you with us.
Great to be here, Tim. Thank you.
Okay, summarize for us briefly, Jay, first, why former President Trump is on trial up in Fort Pierce, and second, the ruling that Judge Cannon issued this week in the Trump documents trial that's got so many legal experts in a tizzy. I mean, this mostly has to do with issues surrounding evidence that might be classified, or SEPA issues, as they're known. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so when the president left the, you know, White House, at the end of his term in January 2020, he took with him boxes and boxes and boxes of personal items and, as it turned out, classified information, classified materials. Right. And the National Archives, over several months, asked him to return them. And he resisted, and he resisted. And finally, he returned some, but not many. And then the FBI got involved because the referral was made, and the FBI quickly determined, through sourcing and through, you know, cooperators behind the scenes, that the president was withholding more of these documents. They asked for more. He turned over more, but he didn't turn over all of them because it became known, you know, based on video footage of Mar-a-Lago, his estate in Palm Beach, where he kept these records, that he had moved the records around. And then ultimately that led to a warrant being issued by a judge.
Right. So what got him into trouble was not just holding on to these classified documents, but the obstruction aspect of his conduct.
That's correct. In fact, a lot of people would say just merely possessing them probably wouldn't have resulted in an indictment. But what he did was he withheld them under the Espionage Act. Right. And then he took efforts to obstruct justice, at least that's what the indictment says, by attempting to delete the video footage of the rooms where they were stored, and also moving the documents around within, kind of a cat and mouse game.
Yeah, but again, going to this delay ruling then that Judge Cannon issued, one of her big claims is that these are very complicated classified documents issues that this trial is dealing with, and therefore more time is simply needed then before this trial can really begin. Is that the basis of her ruling?
Yeah, that's the basis of her ruling. And so the reality is, you know, she is a relatively new judge. She was, you know, nominated and confirmed in the waning days of President Trump's administration. And, you know, she didn't have a lot of experience as a prosecutor. She was known as a good writer, wrote good briefs, did appellate work, and was confirmed because she was one of the few people that really wanted to work as a judge in the northern edge of the district in Fort Pierce. And so, in a nutshell, she and, you know, she's assigned this very controversial case, and it involves handling of so-called classified Information Procedures Act materials. Mm-hmm. Very complex, very difficult. You need security clearances. And so it introduces a lot of factors that are not typical of most cases.
But why are so many legal experts insisting this delay that she set this week is not warranted? Where is this coming from?
Well, it's coming from the fact that what she doesn't say in her opinion, which is highly legalistic, and you read bits and pieces of it, the most, you know, relevant parts in your introduction, what she's not saying is that she's kind of contributed to this delay. The fact that she has taken a long time to address, you know, a whole schedule of motions and pleadings, mm-hmm. including motions to dismiss for this reason or that reasons, and the handling of these so-called SEPA materials. And so she sort of created this issue, and it compounded itself. And this is not unusual. So, in fairness to her, a lot of judges who deal with these SEPA motions mm-hmm. face these problems, and you get delays. And then again, and the backdrop is, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court, which she hasn't even mentioned in any of her pleadings, but or not her pleadings, but her opinions. But, you know, they're deciding whether or not, you know, the former president has
immunity. Yeah, right. So, but just as important, why are so many legal experts saying that this indefinite delay that Judge Cannon has ordered reflects a not very strong understanding of the legal and constitutional issues involved in this case on her behalf, that she was perhaps not prepared for a case of this magnitude and complexity? Because, you know, as you just mentioned, a lot of judges might not be prepared for something this complex.
That's correct. And so, look, I mean, there's personality and then there are legal issues. I mean, a lot of the left-leaning and liberal, you know, constitutional scholars have been nitpicking everything she does.
Yeah.
And I've talked with more moderate folks, you know, and not just, you know, Republican conservatives, but more moderate folks. And they say that, you know, she's moving the schedule along, but she could have moved it faster. And that's why you're hearing all this howling. Now, why? My belief is because this is the cleanest case there is. And a lot of the liberals and left-leaning types really want this case to go to trial, because even William Barr said, mm-hmm. you know, his former attorney general said, he made a big mistake here. He broke the law. He was withholding these documents, and they shouldn't have been withheld, and he should have turned them over. So there's been this push to get this case to trial. But, you know, as things turned out, it's not happening that way, because we currently have a trial in the state court in New York on this, you know, the Stormy Daniels matter.
But they essentially feel she's dragging her feet on what should be a slam dunk.
Yes, and she's also made decisions dealing with how she's dismissed motions, you know, to throw out the case. And she's dismissed them, but, you know, she has said that she's going to keep these issues open right up until jury instructions. And that has causing conniption fits for Jack Smith in the special counsel's office.
But above that, a lot of her critics also claim that she has, in fact, in the past sort of suggested, if not outright asserted, that Trump deserves special treatment in this case because he's a former president?
Yes, but let's make sure we keep it clear for your viewers. So after the FBI did the raid, and this is complex, but I'm going to make it as simple as possible.
Sure.
There was a question about the raid in August 2022 and whether it was lawful. And notwithstanding the fact that she determined that it was done in good faith, she went on to say, but we're dealing with a former president. We should have a special master who should be able to parse through every single one of these documents, separating the wheat from the chaff, that is, the personal documents mm-hmm. from the classified documents. And they go through filter teams and taint teams, but she wanted another party to look at it. And she went too far, and she got slammed by the 11th Circuit. And
exactly.
A lot of people thought, there's not even jurisdiction here. The 11th Circuit, all Republican appointees said, there is no jurisdiction here. They acted in good faith. You don't get to go any farther in your analysis. Mm-hmm. So the FBI acted in good faith. You took this too far. You should never have allowed a former president to contest pre-indictment the lawfulness of the search warrant.
Right, and I want to get to that in a second. But also, to be fair to her, don't we have to weigh this bias accusation against the fact that Cannon has, as we've mentioned, has earlier ruled against Trump at one point during the preparation for this trial, specifically involving his bid to just throw out the case altogether.
Correct. And so, you know, he has invoked the Presidential Records Act, which basically says, in plain terms, I possess these records. They're mine. I can do whatever I want with them.
Right.
Well,
And the big distinction here being, I think one of the big issues to explain to our listeners, you know, his side of the court is suggesting that, no, under the Presidential Records Act, he was just doing what was within his rights. But you mentioned earlier, and this is important, we're also dealing with the Espionage Act, which deals with his mishandling and obstruction.
Correct.
And she seemed to be siding with the side that says we should be focusing on the Espionage Act.
Well, Jack Smith has smart and his team have smartly crafted this indictment to be entirely built upon the Espionage Act,
yeah.
Which means that if you don't get authority to possess these records, you don't get to keep them, and they must be turned over to the National Archives. They belong to the U.S. government. And she made the point that there is nothing in the entire indictment that speaks to the Presidential Records Act.
Right.
And so she said, absent that, you have no legal foundation to dismiss this case. And so, in so many words, she says, I'm throwing out your motion to dismiss this case because you have no legal basis to do so.
Right. So at least she's done that. But still, it would seem Cannon's trial delay ruling this week did not exactly boost confidence in her performance, given that, as you mentioned earlier, that during the course of this case, she's already had a ruling reversed by the Federal Appeals Court. And last month, she had to reverse herself and admit that Special Prosecutor Jack Smith was right on another issue about revealing witness identities.
Correct.
In fact, legal experts asserted that if she hadn't reversed her opinion in that question, Smith could have had good grounds to request her removal from the trial, no?
He could have, but it's a little late in the game for that.
Right.
And it would have been highly unusual. And, you know, what he was fighting over in that instance is very common. Witnesses, are often protected in these SEPA cases, especially when you don't want to disclose them because it could bring some sort of damage to national security or to the witness himself. So he was right on that point. The other fight he's having with her, though, is over the jury instructions at this early stage.
Yeah.
But she basically threw this out, you know, with an indefinite postponement, and that just irritated a lot of people.
Yep. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Jay Weaver about the controversy swirling around federal judge Aileen Cannon of Miami in the Trump documents trial. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Jay, I want to step back from the Trump trial for a moment and look at Judge Cannon's South Florida roots. As I mentioned at the outset, she was born in Cali, Colombia, but she's part Cuban on her mother's side. And as I said, her trajectory here was pretty impressive. She attended Ransom Everglades, one of Miami's more exclusive prep schools. She's a graduate of Duke University and the University of Michigan Law School. She was a federal prosecutor here in Miami, and then she gets appointed to the federal bench by Trump a few years ago at the age of only 39. From what you've observed, what are the strengths that propelled her like this career-wise?
Well, look, you know, my sense is she was not ready for prime time. Her appointment was premature. It may never have been made but for the fact that the Federalist Society championed her cause to become, you know.
Right, and we should point out the Federalist Society being a very conservative legal organization that promotes things like a very traditional interpretation of the Constitution.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Now, I'm not suggesting she wasn't intellectually capable of being a federal judge. She was. But usually when you're a federal judge, you come to the bench with a lot more experience. It can be from the state circuit court as a judge. It can be, you know, as a magistrate judge. It can be as a former federal prosecutor who's done trial after trial. You know, it can even be from the public defender's office. We have a former federal public defender who's a sitting judge. She just didn't have that resume. She didn't have a working resume. She had an intellectual ivory tower resume with a few years in the system. But she got picked because Trump's people went out of their way.
Including Senator Marco Rubio.
Correct. Yeah. Marco Rubio absolutely went out of their way.
Right.
You know, to pick her. And they did that because there aren't a lot of choices. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, choices among Democrats. There aren't as many choices among Republicans. And you know, one could argue that she actually had a little more gravitas than some of the other Trump appointments around the country. So in fairness to her.
Right. But so given all these considerations, though, then is it understandable or unfair for those who oppose Trump to suggest there's a conflict of interest here, that Cannon is, let's say, helping him run out the clock so that if he wins the November election, he can then make this criminal trial go away forever?
Well, there is, but I'm a journalist and I'm looking at this and I'm thinking to myself, okay, which case should go first, if any case on the federal level goes first?
Yeah.
And everybody is saying, of course, the election interference case, the January 6th case.
Which is going to be held in Washington,
which is going to be held in Washington. And
yeah.
So everybody thinks if any case should come before the election, that should be it.
And then and a state level version of that playing out in Georgia.
Georgia, which... Right. Would probably never come, would never take precedent over a federal case.
Okay.
And so I don't know if there's time or a place for this documents case. And you know, what's unfortunate about this is it's the cleanest case. It's the simplest case. It's the most straightforward case.
Uh-huh.
And yet that's why people are upset about it. But you know, it's funny. It was the first case filed of the four that we've talked about. It was returned here in Miami. There was a big zoo
right,
here.
Miami grand jury. Yeah.
Yeah. There was an arraignment here. All of that, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know if we'll see this case go to trial before the election day.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, what's your best guess then in terms of this trial, when it could actually begin? Most folks now seem to feel it won't start until after the November election. You
agree?
Correct. Yeah.
I do tend to agree. And, yeah. But there's a reason why. It's more of a practical consideration. If the Supreme Court comes back in a matter of weeks with some partial immunity, I don't think that this case will be shot down on that basis. I think it'll go forward, the documents case. But the case that'll be more pressing, more important to the American people in the Justice Department will be the January 6th case, the election interference case.
Mm-hmm.
And that will probably take precedent, which will probably make it impossible to squeeze this documents case in as a trial before Election Day.
Right. Now, finally then, Jay, given the background of Judge Cannon that we've just been talking about and how she was selected and the relative, perhaps, inexperience that she brought to the bench when she was plucked for it by President Trump, in the larger picture, does this controversy raise again the question of whether our judiciary, especially the federal judiciary that you cover, is becoming more politically partisan and in the process becoming perhaps less legally sound?
You know, one could make that argument, but, you know, let's bear in mind that the more relevant part of the legal landscape of America happens in the appellate courts, happens at the Supreme Court.
Good
and,
point. Yeah.
And so you make, you know, mistakes that are harmful at the lower court level, they'll be presumably corrected at the appellate level.
Right.
Now, of course, presidents appoint appellate judges and U.S. Supreme Court judges. Mm-hmm. And are there ideological biases there? Yes. And, you know, and are they steeped in this kind of conservative federalist society, you know, notion of originalism and textualism?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Right.
So there is an ideology permeating this landscape,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you see it at the district court level, too, but not to the same extent.
All right. Great points, all. Jay Weaver covers federal courts and crimes for the Miami Herald. Jay, thanks as always.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Still to come, WLRN's education reporter bids farewell and shares some last important thoughts. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Kate Payne joined WLRN as our education reporter in 2022. Her professional timing was impeccable. In those 2 years, she's covered some of the most contentious and consequential schools and university issues that Florida and especially South Florida have ever wrestled with. Everything from culture war disputes like book banning and DEI to brick-and-mortar crises like declining school enrollment and alarming teacher shortages. And through it all, Kate brought a just as impeccable mix of sharp analysis and thoughtful empathy to every report she aired and every great conversation we had here on this program. This is Kate's last day with WLRN. She's moving on to a great new gig with the Associated Press in Tallahassee. But before she leaves, we wanted to touch base with her one more time and get her thoughts on where education stands right now in South Florida, and more importantly, where it's going in the face of the myriad social and economic pressures it's facing right now. Maybe you have some education questions or comments for Kate. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio one last time is Kate Payne. Kate, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Now, as you and I always do on this show, I want to start with the news. And this week, that means concerns surrounding Broward County's Redefining Our Schools campaign. It just doesn't seem to be launching the way they'd hoped. Kate, remind us briefly what this very important public schools effort is in Broward, especially as it relates to declining enrollment and school closures, and what are the snags the district is running into, especially with yet again a sudden pivot to a new school superintendent up there.
So much to unpack here.
Yes.
But yes, as we're saying, there are 50,000 empty seats in Broward classrooms when we look at the overall capacity of the district. And it's that enrollment crisis that is spurring the district to reconcile with closing and consolidating schools, doing this massive district-wide effort. And that effort was spearheaded by now former superintendent Peter Licata, who abruptly resigned recently.
Retiring because of health issues.
Due to health issues, that's right. And so his deputy, now superintendent Howard Hepburn, has taken this on and has laid out this working proposal, still, you know, in the process, but to close three schools and to redraw boundaries or change programs at dozens of other schools across the district. Again, this is very much still in the works. We'll hear an updated proposal next week.
Yeah. And it's not just about school closures. It's also about an effort to make public schools in Broward more attractive to families who might be thinking of ditching public schools.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so doing things like redrawing school boundaries, turning, you know, some K through 5 elementary schools into K through 8 schools, mm-hmm. which is really appealing to a lot of families, and that some families have been asking for years, and the district didn't respond to.
Right.
So it's, in some sense, some of these things are, you know, hopefully not too little too late for the district.
No.
But
One case you reported on this week, the Virginia Schumann Young Elementary School uproar, seems a showcase of parental frustration in this regard, no?
Right. And so that's an elementary school in Fort Lauderdale with a beloved Montessori program.
Yeah.
So families apply in. They say they won the lottery when they get a seat because they're literally applying for a lottery to get their kid into this program, which they love. And this Montessori program under this proposal would be moved to a different school. The thinking being that, you know, families in the surrounding neighborhood around Virginia Schumann Young, you know, not enough of them can get into this school. And,
yeah.
you know, trying to pull those families back in to the district. But for the families and students and teachers who are there now, you know, they're saying, we love this school. This should be a model that you should replicate,
yeah.
not dismantle. And so there was a huge showing of support from those families at one of the town halls this week, all in matching blue T-shirts, at some points really yelling down district officials trying to articulate these proposals.
And as you pointed out, this could all have many Broward parents saying that this Redefining Our Schools initiative is perhaps having the opposite effect that was intended, and that it may now be prompting them to put their kids in private schools instead of attracting them to public schools.
Absolutely. And some of these parents were very explicit about that, saying, you know, again, at this school in particular, they are applying in for the specialized program. They have the means and the privilege, frankly, to be making those decisions, and were very explicit about saying, this Montessori program at VSY is what is keeping my children in public schools. And if you take it away, I will take my children away
yeah.
and move them into a private option.
Right. Now, that, of course, brings us to one of those schools issues that you seem to feel is going to weigh particularly heavily on Florida and South Florida, and that's school choice. Especially the state's recent move to offer private school vouchers to any family, regardless of income. Why is that going to have perhaps an outsized effect moving forward, Kate?
I mean, in the instance, you know, we were just talking about of, you know, those families seeing their programs disappear, you know, as I put it in one of my stories this week, it's arguably never been easier to follow through on that threat of, you know, if you as a parent are not satisfied with your traditional neighborhood school, of taking your child out and putting them in a private school, because there is this state voucher regardless of family income.
Even if you're a very affluent family, yeah.
Absolutely. And so it's, you know, for those advocates, it's really empowered families to make, you know, very different decisions about moving their kids to a whole range of, whether it's charter school, private school, homeschool, micro school. You know, we've seen this explosion of what it means to go to school in Florida. But, you know, for traditional public schools, it really is eating into their model,
yeah, I
their
mean,
existence.
And I don't want to sound apocalyptic, but does this have the potential to sort of drive the last nail in the coffin into public education in Florida?
It's certainly the fear and the concern for many of these officials, for many of these teachers. You know, I just think of so many teachers in our traditional public schools right now who are approaching or reaching retirement age and are hanging on, you know, for their retirement. And when they go, you know, where will we be? There are not enough people who want to go into education to become teachers, and we're we're really in for it.
We have Juan on the line from Miami, and he's got some thoughts along the line of this this topic we're just discussing at this moment. Juan, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Hi. Yes. Good afternoon. I had a question for you guys. I just wanted to know whether you guys thought it was legal, as far as, you know, our us the taxpayers and property owners who pay the taxes that fund these public schools, if it's legal for the governor to distribute those funds to a public company such as charter schools.
Right. No, that's an often asked question, Juan. Very good one. Kate, what would you say at this point?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, Florida has become a laboratory for school choice, where state lawmakers have really, for years, been working towards establishing this legal framework to allow for this spectrum of different kinds of schools, charter schools and otherwise. And we see, you know, again and again, state lawmakers, you know, building out that system of providing more ways for public funding, including through voter-approved tax referendums, to be shared with charter schools in addition to traditional public schools. So it's a constantly shifting landscape, but yeah.
Well, let's shift then to the culture war issue, which has seemed to overshadow most, if not all, the other education issues here over the past couple of years that you've been covering. You and I have talked more than once on this show about the whole book banning controversy that's arisen under Republican Governor Ron DeSantis' administration and his state education commissioner, Manny Diaz, especially when it comes to issues like gender and race. But has it really become the censorship specter many feared it would be, or were those fears overblown in the end?
You know, I think like a lot of things, it's complicated. You know, on one hand, I've talked to teachers who have moved to a different school, who have left classroom teaching, or even left the classroom entirely because of the scrutiny around their curriculum, around, you know, what books kids can read, and will a parent complain, and, you know, do these teachers feel that they have the backing, the support of their administrators if there is a complaint that's made? I think it varies a lot. You know, stepping back, reviews by the advocacy group PEN America, by the American Library Association, have found that Florida continues to lead the country in book challenges. A lot of those challenges are coming from a very small number of people. Mm-hmm. A review by the Washington Post found it was something like 11 people responsible for more than half in one school year. Mm-hmm. So it varies a lot.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with education reporter Kate Payne on her farewell day at WLRN about the tumultuous state of education in South Florida. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, Kate, another big culture war issue in education, of course, has been DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, which has a bigger effect on higher education here. The University of Florida, for example, seems to have just raised the surrender flag on this one. But what are the lasting consequences of this that you think we should be most concerned about?
So I did a recent story on this looking at Florida Atlantic University in Palm Beach County, where there is an on-campus diversity office that was quietly shut down as part of this DEI ban on campuses. And so, you know, it was an office that had five full-time staff that were dedicated to helping Black, Latino, and queer students navigate higher ed, you know, if they were facing financial challenges, this was a place they could go. If they needed a place to hang out, this was a place they could go to get, you know, social support and real social services as well. Mm-hmm. And so it's places like that that have been quietly shut down where there had been professional staff dedicated there, you know, for students who are no longer there, who have been reassigned, who have left, and to a certain extent, students themselves are having to take on some of those responsibilities.
But Republicans have been very successful at pointing at DEI, not so much in its original intent, but pointing to it as the source of, for example, keeping conservative voices and opinions off of college campuses, that sort of thing, sort of a reverse censorship sort of thing that we should point out. Kate, let's pivot to another larger picture issue that you think we'll need to keep an eye on moving forward, and that's the student mental health issue, particularly when it comes to youth social media use, which, of course, was a big topic in the Florida State Legislature this year. What do you foresee as the most important ways we're going to have to keep dealing with that here?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, just look around us, yeah. And you can see the smallest of children glued to their phones. You know, there are so many, just a constellation of issues when it comes to social media, of, you know, just how addictive it is, its effect on our attention spans, critical thinking, you know, your sense of the world, your sense of self, body image, especially for young people, girls in particular, and how we've seen this coincide with thoughts of suicidal ideation, of like, mm-hmm. of real desperation among young people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think for school officials, they also say it's sort of an accelerant, social media and phone usage, of when there are fights on campus, there are rumors, it just makes all of that so much worse.
No, that point well taken. And in fact, as a journalist and a writer, that brings me to a related and more personal question I wanted to ask you while we've still got you here. And that's whether you think South Florida schools are doing enough to counter the, shall we say, literacy hindering effects of social media on students' reading and writing skills, essential communication skills.
Sure. I think that's huge. And I think, you know, for a lot of school officials, it's, you know, they want to be empowered to set limits on phone use in class. And, you know, to the extent that they can do that and bring students back into the classroom, you know, back into focus, so that they can really deal with the literacy crisis that we're facing with our students.
Which, as you mentioned before to me, the pandemic didn't help that at all either.
Not at all. And so, again, we're seeing, you know, with the pandemic and that shift to virtual education, kids being on their phones, on their computers from the youngest of ages, trying to bring them back into the real world, into the classroom, and help rebuild those actual social skills as well.
Right. And along those lines, regarding the pandemic, I know you also feel the loss of COVID funds could have a palpable impact on South Florida schools.
This is huge. You know, federal COVID funds have really kept a lot of districts afloat, helped students hang on during, again, this incredibly disruptive, traumatic time. You know, there are so many staff positions, targeted tutoring, summer school programs that were funded by this, and that is going away.
That's just one of the great insights we've benefited from with your reporting, Kate, over the past couple of years. Kate Payne is WLRN's education reporter and is now moving on to the Associated Press in Tallahassee. You can keep up with her on X at Hello Kate Payne. Kate, we wish you the very best on your new journey, and thank you for the truly engaging work you've done here in South Florida.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a joy.
Still to come, Panama's president-elect wants to close the Darien Gap to migrants, like the thousands who come here. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. On Sunday, Panama elected a new right-wing president, Jose Raul Mulino. The 64-year-old former public security minister was a stand-in for former president Ricardo Martinelli. Martinelli's candidacy was canceled after he was recently convicted on corruption charges stemming from his first presidency a decade ago. Even so, Martinelli remains a popular figure in Panama, so his proxy, Mulino, won easily, 10 percentage points ahead of his closest rival. He pledges to revive Panama's moribund economy. But for folks in South Florida, Mulino's most important campaign promise isn't about economics, but immigration. He wants to close off the jungle corridor into Panama, known as the Darien Gap, to migrants heading to the U.S. And that includes the thousands of Venezuelan and other migrants who use that route to come here. Coincidentally, Mulino won the election the same week the U.S. pledged $587 million to help countries like Panama deal with the hemisphere's migrant overflow crisis. Do you have friends or family who've come here or plan to come here through the Darien? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Will Freeman. He's a Latin American Studies Fellow at the nonprofit Council on Foreign Relations in New York, who follows Panama closely and was recently at the Darien Gap. He's speaking with us today from the Hemispheric Security Conference at Florida International University here in Miami. Will, how are you?
Hi, Tim. I'm well. How are you?
Thanks for joining us. Let's start with Jose Raul Mulino himself, Will. Tell us a little bit about him and how a last-minute candidate like him ended up winning Panama's presidency so decisively last Sunday.
Jose Raul Mulino, a longtime figure in Panamanian politics, he served as foreign minister and security minister under the ex-president you mentioned, that popular charismatic leader Ricardo Martinelli, who was in office from 2009 to 2014.
Right.
So Mulino really established himself then, but he has his own base of political supporters in the country. That said, nobody really expected him to enter the race until Martinelli's corruption issues sidelined him. So I think Mulino was able to bring sort of the perfect combo to the table for Martinelli. He's both loyal, but he also had his own engine behind him in terms of supporters he could rally.
Right.
And just to put this in broader perspective, Panama, long seen as a sort of success story in Central America, a country which has grown rapidly in terms of its economy since the 1990s, often doing much better than its neighbors, it's hit a rough patch.
Right.
A few months ago, there were massive protests to close down a copper mine, which accounts for something like 4 or 5% of the country's GDP.
Right.
There have been other massive protests over corruption or perceptions of corruption. And you have this controversial judicial case against Martinelli, even as he remains quite a popular leader.
Right. So a place that we were sort of calling the Singapore of Central America isn't looking as hot anymore. Yeah.
Right. And just to add to that, I mean, the Panama Canal, right? What's the feature that makes the country best abroad? They've had a backlog. They haven't been able to run as many ships through there as normal because of water flow problems. So
yeah,
it's quite a tricky moment, and that, I think, elevated Mulino last minute.
Right. But why do so many Panamanians look back on Martinelli's presidency as a positive time for the country, despite all the, frankly, ugly corruption he's been convicted for?
That's right, and that's not all. He also, stands accused, and quite credibly accused, of having used espionage on his political opponents, even some of their family members. It was a bit of a nasty time politically, but it was great times economically. The economy was booming. There was surging growth. Panama had opened relations with China and signed a free trade agreement, which also contributed to that growth. So I think people look back on it and see it as a time when, A, the economy was booming, and B, Martinelli as president built massive public infrastructure like the metro system that Panama
public transit,
today.
Right.
Yeah.
So it seems then that Panamanians are in a more conservative mindset these days, and as we're seeing here in the U.S., that's created more anti-immigration sentiment in the country, and most of that stems from the hundreds of thousands of migrants who are coming into Panama through the Darien Gap on their way to the U.S. About a half a million people last year. No, how has that migrant wave in recent years affected Panama, Will?
Well, you know, it started out when the Darien route really began booming, say, the late 2010s, and then certainly after the pandemic, that you were seeing a lot more transit through Panama than ever before. As mm-hmm. you mentioned, hundreds of thousands of people now every year. But what you've also seen is several tens, about hundreds of thousands of people deciding to stay in Panama, largely uh-huh. Venezuelans, but also a mix of other nationalities. That's pretty new for Panama. It's a country of immigrants. You know, if you go decades, even 100 sure. years back, people came all over the world to live there, to work on the canal. But now there's this new immigration wave, and I think Molino's election shows us there's something of a political backlash.
Right, which causes a lot of anxiety when you're a country that's dealing with a moribund economy.
Right, and when you're a small country where even, yeah. you know, say a few extra tens of thousands of immigrants, that's really noticeable.
Right, that's a very good point as well. What then exactly has Molino pledged to do to reduce that migrant wave into Panama, especially as it pertains to closing off the Darién to those migrants?
Well, following in Martinelli's mold, his populist mold, the promises are pretty big, pretty bombastic. They're short on specifics. So he said that he'll shut down the Darién, but I can tell you, having been there, it's really hard to imagine how that would work. You know, where the routes from the jungle are kind of entering Panamanian territory, and then the first towns and first roads you get to, it's a pretty, you know, it's an area the state only barely controls. So the idea that you could somehow, without a military, remember, Panama doesn't have.
Yeah, and we should point out here that this is the Darién is a very dangerous place to transit, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I mean, until they were recently expelled from the country, Doctors Without Borders was documenting so many cases of sexual abuse and violence, of other types of, you know, criminal predation on these migrants traveling through. I mean, it's really an epidemic.
But given this, all this, Will, if I'm, say, a Venezuelan family here in South Florida mm-hmm. who has relatives making plans yeah. to escape Venezuela's historic humanitarian crisis and come to the U.S. southern mm-hmm. border to seek asylum, let's say, should I be worried now that those relatives will no longer be able to use the Darién as a route?
I think it's really hard to say, but I'll just underscore again that I think promising to close the Darién is clearly a campaign promise to Panamanians. I don't know how feasible that is in reality. He right. may try, and we may see Panama's border guard dispatched in numbers we've never seen before to, I don't know, simply stand in a line at the end of the routes that leave the jungle there. But I'm really not sure what they do once you have tens and maybe even more than just tens of thousands of people all arriving and stuck there in the south of Panama.
Seems a little reminiscent of former President Donald Trump's failed promise to erect mm-hmm. a border wall here in the U.S., no?
With one key difference, right, that Trump could set up so-called safe third country agreements and send, you know, ask right. Countries in the region, or more or less force them to take on immigrants. Panama's a small, not very powerful country. It can't particularly put those terms on a neighbor to the south like
Very
Colombia,
good right? point. So as you told me earlier this week, you think the status quo is probably going to hold. They'll just have to keep on receiving these migrants through the Darién, keep them in camps for a while, and then, as you said, bus them to the Costa Rica border?
That's how it's functioned so far, and I do think we'll still see that. But, you know, who knows? If this becomes really a priority for Molino, maybe he does crack down in a way that human smugglers from Colombia begin to travel larger distances by boat, perhaps even trying to reach Costa Rica or points further right. north. So.
Good point. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Will Freeman of the Council on Foreign Relations about the Panama election and the winner's plans to close the Darién gap to migrants. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Will, let's listen to a short cut here of Molino making that Darién closure pledge during his campaign. Do we have
his... Y vamos a cerrar Darién y vamos a repatriar a todas estas personas como corresponda, respetando los derechos humanos. Y espero y confío que el ACNUR de Naciones Unidas nos ayude.
Now, Molino there insists that Panama is going to deport migrants who try to come through the Darién. But you hear there, Will, at the end, that he's also saying he's expecting the U.S. to help him in mm-hmm. that effort. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, this week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, at an immigration mm-hmm. conference in Guatemala, pledged $587 million to help Latin American countries like Panama deal with this crisis. Does that mean the U.S. perhaps intends to help Molino close the Darién gap?
Look, I'm sure they're going to continue and maybe even increase support to Panama, but I don't think that this is a problem you can spend your way out of. Right, as long as there's such a pull to come to the U.S. because of the exceptionally hot labor market, the fact that there's 1.5 jobs open for every unemployed person, and as long as you have these crises in Latin America, I just don't see how spending more is necessarily going to shut down completely these routes. People will find a way.
Right, and this sort of goes back to the debate that, we shouldn't be trying to perhaps confront illegal immigration at the borders, but rather at the sources, countries like Venezuela, right?
I agree. Yes, absolutely.
Now, Will, as I mentioned, you're talking with us from FIU's annual Hemispheric Security Conference, and I'm curious, is immigration playing a prominent role in the hemispheric security discussion there or here?
No. Absolutely. You know, this is a conference that focuses in part on organized crime, and I think we're all concerned about the way that we've seen organized crime move into this sector. It's become, you know, sort of a new boom economy. And, of course, you know, I've just been here a few days in South Florida, talked to several recent immigrants who describe traveling this exact route and, you know, ultimately paying sums in the, you know, that exceed $10,000. So many people in the underworld criminally are getting rich off this, and that's a concern for folks who focus on security.
Well, how much of this $587 million then would you tell folks is probably going to be spent on things like trying to regulate migration and help migrants who are coming through countries like Panama, but also to combat things like the organized crime, for example, that for years has driven illegal migration out of countries like Honduras?
Right, right. I think that there will be a focus on those root causes. I mean, certainly there already is in the framework of the Biden administration's policy towards the region. But the question is if the U.S. is really powerful enough anymore to change conditions on the ground. Look at a case like Venezuela. I'd argue that right now our influence there, we have influence certainly, but we can't dictate the terms. We can't decide what happens, right? Maduro is simply too entrenched. You could say the same of Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. Or of the gang violence problem in Ecuador. So there's more we can do, but also I think we need to be realistic. The drivers behind migration aren't going away tomorrow. These problems take decades to solve.
Now, as you mentioned, you're taking part, you took part, I think it was yesterday, in a panel there at FIU on how transnational criminal organizations are impacting hemispheric security. How do they figure into the hemispheric immigration crisis? You mentioned before that this especially involves things like human smuggling, which is also a big concern at the Darien Gap, right?
Yeah, it varies country by country. So, you know, in some countries, Panama being one of them, a lot of the services provided to migrants are being provided by kind of local brokers. They're not necessarily criminals. They're people selling food along the routes. They're people providing guiding services. They're providing boats to transit rivers. And their bus companies are actually contracted by the government. But then you go to a country like Mexico or the north of Colombia, and there are very powerful criminal cartels that are running the business. So I think in those hotspots, they are part of what's stimulating this or facilitating it. But that's not to say that if you get rid of these criminal cartels from today to tomorrow, you're all of a sudden going to, you know, have a hemisphere without migration. People will still find ways to move. But a lot of the abuses and the worst parts of the humanitarian crisis, they're directly tied to these criminal groups.
Right, and very equivalent to the coyote situation we have on the U.S. southern border.
That's right.
Right. Now, finally, Will, I wanted to ask you where we might see other out-migration hotspots in Latin America in the future besides Venezuela. You mentioned Ecuador before. Are other crime-ravaged countries like Ecuador prime candidates for sending migrants through the Darien as well?
You know, that's a high bar to pass. Ecuador's surge was just, you know, meteoric in terms of the numbers. But I've been keeping my eye on Peru. I'm particularly worried about Peru. Another country like Panama that was long seen as an economic success story, its economy has hit quite hard times.
Right.
Its politics is dysfunctional and increasingly authoritarian. So I'm quite worried about that country being able to turn the corner, to be honest.
Well, gives us a lot to think about then. Will Freeman is a Latin American Studies Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Will, many thanks. We really appreciate your insights.
Thanks for having me on.
Finally on the roundup, we also say best of luck and buena suerte to renowned Miami Herald columnist Fabiola Santiago. After 44 years at the newspaper, which she joined just a decade after arriving in Miami on a Freedom flight out of Cuba, Santiago is unplugging her keyboard and retiring. Santiago was known for her gutsy, refreshing, and always eloquent willingness to confront the abuse and hypocrisy of power, whether it was in Miami or Havana. Last year, she described for the WLRN program Sundial her column writing process.
I quickly learned that it is in the process of writing that I come up with an opinion. I have a feeling, right? I have something that triggers my interest in the topic, and then I follow through. And when I'm writing, I'm also considering, right? I always have in mind the people I'm writing about and my readers as well, right? What do I owe them? What do I owe the people that I'm writing about? And how can this contribute to something?
Santiago is also a novelist, the author of Reclaiming Paris. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Helen Acevedo with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.